Plato. Welcome to this special podcast of Science Friday from sciencefriday.com. Earlier this week, the Senate voted to keep open the possibility of drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Responding to that vote, thousands of environmentalists across the country did what? Did you see any mass protests? Or anybody marching on Washington? I didn't see any. And not too long ago, the government came out with warnings about eating some of our most favorite foods, tuna and salmon, so polluted with mercury and pesticides that we've got to limit what we eat. Did you hear much about that? Any protests, mass march? Ditto here. Oil jumps to almost $60 a barrel, driving up the cost of heating homes, operating school buses. Do you see any energy conservation experts get much airtime, saying how much money could have been saved with just a bump up in gasoline mileage standards? Countries in the rest of the world are taking dramatic steps to cut back on greenhouse gas emissions. Not the U.S. We just heard about the oceans rising, the climates are changing. Does anyone in this country really care or know what time it is, like we say it's time to change? Critics might say that these examples are just the latest indication that the environmental movement is on a respirator. It's on its way out. They claim that instead of a true movement, what we have here is really a bunch of nonprofit organizations that people send money to in exchange for a t-shirt or maybe a tote bag. Needless to say, the characterization of the environmental movement hasn't gone over so well with some environmental groups. What do you think? Is the environmental movement dead? Has it lost its teeth? Has it been marginalized? Are people who stand up for conservation, clean air, and water just tree huggers, leftist liberals, remnants of the 60s and 70s have lost touch with the public? How else could you explain their inability to foster change? Or even worse, are they hypocrites who might fight for wind power but refuse to allow wind energy to spoil their landscape? Is what we have left Erin Brockovich working by herself? If so, what would it take to revitalize the environmental movement? If you'd like to get on with the conversation with us, I invite you to give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guest. Michael Schellenberger is the executive director of the Breakthrough Institute. He's also the author of this controversial paper, The Death of Environmentalism, which was published in the online magazine Grist. He joins us from the campus of the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Bill McKibben is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, Outside Magazine, and a New York Review of Books. He is also author of $100 Holiday, published by Simon & Schuster, and The End of Nature, put out by Random House. He joins us from the campus of Middlebury College, where he is a scholar in residence. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello there, Ira.
Hi. John Kaufman is director of Media Relations for the Natural Resources Defense Council. He joins us here in our studios in New York. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, but this controversial paper you've written in Grist magazine, in which, Michael, you basically say we've got to start over and take apart the environmental movement. It's just not doing anything anymore.
Well, what we actually started, Ira, by saying that the environmental movement has been enormously successful in many regards. In the United States, our waterways are much cleaner than they were 40 years ago. Los Angeles is much, the air is much cleaner, much more free of smog. We've preserved thousands of acres of important wilderness. And the movement has succeeded in putting in place some really important protections of the natural environment and of human beings. What we argue is that really those successes planted the seeds of failure that are now flowering. And so what we're seeing is the environmental movement in the United States really incapable of dealing with the greatest ecological crises to face the future of our species, global warming, global habitat destruction, and other aspects of that, including species extinction and the destruction of the world's oceans. The challenge for the environmental movement is really to evolve into something that's much more powerful, something that's more relevant to people's lives, and something that speaks to Americans' aspirations for a better world. I think we've been telling people for 40 years what they can't have and what they can't be. I think that American progressives and post-environmentalists need to start telling people what they can have and what they can be. We need to start giving the I have a dream speech and not just the I have a nightmare speech.
John Kaufman, how do you react? Is the environmental movement just failing to make any progress on these issues?
Well, there's no question that environmental challenges and global warming in particular are incredibly difficult. The clock is running, and we don't have any more timeouts in this game. We know what the solutions are. To get to them means crossing all sorts of social and cultural and political barriers that really have never been crossed before. For example, NRDC today is working with everybody from hardcore conservative national security groups to world championship snowboarders and the PTA on various global warming initiatives to try and communicate to a much more diverse range of audiences in a relevant, culturally relevant, politically relevant way, both the importance of the problem and the opportunities we have to start solving it. But I think context is important in evaluating whether or not it's time for an obituary. At the federal level, we're up against a White House that is backed to the hilt by the energy industry, that has shown an unprecedented ability to manipulate public debates. At the same time, network newscasts are losing their audiences, newspapers are losing readers. Now, the internet is a great tool, but it's not a mass market tool for going out and replacing those communications channels. So, yeah, I think we're in a changing climate against difficult adversaries, I think that the environmental community has made tremendous progress moving forward on that. And if I had a complaint about the death of environmentalism paper, which raises excellent questions, I would say that the answers come up a little bit short.
Bill McKibben, how has the concept of the environment been so far put into such a box that it has been just pegged to just liberal left-wing tree huggers?
This is the right question. And go back to what Dr. Meal was saying a little bit earlier about carbon dioxide. He was talking about what would happen if we kept stabilized emissions where they are now. But as he implied, we're clearly not going to. Emissions are going through the roof. And if that happens, the world will change in ways that we can even barely begin to imagine now. The problem is, and this gets to your question, there's no way to address that issue, those endless amounts of fossil fuel pouring into the atmosphere, without real basic changes in how we live. It's not like dealing with smog, where you put a catalytic converter on your tailpipe and everything was okay. So the environmental movement was geared for dealing with those sort of questions. It built up a huge head of steam from John Muir and his ideas about wilderness and from Rachel Carson and her ideas about some of the technical dangers of modernity. But now we have to make the case that the world on the other side of this transition from the industrial world we know at the moment will be better than the one we have now. That's the case we have to make to people, and it can't be done in the ways we're doing it at the moment. The vote on ANWR this week made altogether apparent just where the momentum is right now.
And who's going to make that case? There used to be big leaders in the environmental movement. There used to be people who could demand, not literally, but when they spoke, the media listened. Who's there now to speak anything for the environmental movement?
Since the death of David Brower, that was the last sort of those giants. That change, hopefully some of those will arise, but that change is going to have to come from other places right now. It's going to have to come, for instance, from religious communities, including conservative ones, that are now beginning to understand what a stake they have in the preservation of creation on this planet. It's going to need to come from all sorts of places that we don't think of when we immediately think of environmentalism. It'll need to come from a labor movement and from workers who understand that the future lies not in trying to hang on to the last remnants of a cheap energy, SUV economy, but in making the transition to a renewable energy jobs economy.
Michael Schellenberger, you say that one of the problems with the environment is that is the assumption about we mean by the environment, a category that reinforces the notion that, one, the environment is a separate thing, and, B, human beings are separate from and superior to the natural world. How do we make the connection that the environment is connected to everything, to your job, to your work, to whatever you do is either affected by the environment or affects the environment and therefore affects how much money you make or your health or your kids, your job or things like that?
Well, I think that what we need to do is we need to get clear about the kind of world that we want to live in, and we need to create a vision and tell a story about that world that will attract a majority of Americans and a majority of the world's peoples to it. And that means getting clear about the core values that also animate that vision. And I think what we've seen from great corporations and really great social movements is that they're really strict about their core values and vision, uncompromising. But then they're radically flexible and experimental when it comes to their proposals for how to achieve that vision, their strategies and their tactics. And what we've seen out of the environmental movement, at least for the last 20 years, is an ossification, so that there's really a reluctance and a lack of innovation around strategies, proposals, and tactics, and really a willingness to compromise on the core values. So I think that for Americans to get excited about it, a kind of politics that would take us where we need to go in terms of the transformations of the economy that Bill McKibben talked about and the transformations of the culture that John Koifman talked about, we need to really take a step back and make sure that the vision that we're articulating really speaks to the heart of American culture, which is deeply aspirational.
John, did you want to jump in on anything here?
Yeah, I would agree that with the acute challenges we're facing today, we can't afford not to be trying fresh ideas and new angles. And anybody that has good solutions to these challenges, you really needs to be welcome to the table. But at the same time, I think it's a bit unfair of Michael and these authors to characterize the movement as being either flexible in its principles or deeply ossified. I think that we have always focused on very core values of community, of stewardship, of fairness. I think you're hearing a lot more talk these days about security, and certainly health has always been at the core. Nothing, of course, being more immediate to your average person than what's going on with their own body, with their children, with their families. Some of that criticism, I think, is a little bit overblown. At the same time, I absolutely agree, and I think Bill made an excellent point, that we cannot allow ourselves to be painted into an environmentalist box or into a left-wing box. But I also am concerned that some of these solutions and some of the discussion here has drifted towards, that the answer to this is going to somehow lie in a massive cultural shift, a move to progressive values, these sorts of things, which may lock us into an even deeper ghetto. And I'll tell you, the roads to these solutions ultimately are going to run through Washington. They're going to run through the state capitals. And we should be looking for creative ways to engage the public on this. But at the end of the day, we still need to create new rules and new structures that limit global warming, pollution, and other dangerous threats to our society.
But you've got to get the public interested in these things.
Absolutely.
Right? You've got to get them motivated. You've got to get them interested. They don't seem to be, Europe is certainly motivated and interested. And they, what happened there? Why haven't we got that here? Go ahead.
And I should just say, too, that I think that if anything gives me hope that the environmental movement can evolve into something more relevant and powerful, it's people like John Koifman who really are representing the next generation of thinkers within those big institutions. But I would point out that really the two principal policy proposals that the environmental movement has been pushing for the last 20 years, higher fuel economy standards for cars, trucks, and SUVs, and a cap and trade system on greenhouse gas emissions, are very old ideas. And if you look in 1990, there were 59 votes in the Senate to raise fuel economy standards. In 2002, environmentalists only got 38. That's an indication that the lack of innovation in terms of coming up with new proposals to achieve similar ends has resulted in environmentalists being weaker now in Washington than they've been in the entire 40-year history of the modern environmental movement. And I think some pretty deep self-reflection and self-criticism needs to take place within the environmental movement how to be innovating. I mean, you couldn't be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company and be selling the same products you were selling 20 years ago if they were no longer selling.
Well, it doesn't seem to me that how much innovation, do things need. Let's take an example of the mercury emissions from the smokestacks that has been being talked about and the cap and trade on that. And from what I understand, the legislation is that the difference between the administration bill and an environmental bill is about 10 years in enforcement. And when it would go into effect, it would be 10 years later. And if an environmentalist, you know, was willing to settle for that, you know, then that's one thing. But you might other people might say, 10 years, that's a lot of people who are going to die from mercury exposure. Why should we be willing to settle for that? 10 years of pollution, where we might be able to shorten that into, you know, by forcing, instead of capping and trading, by forcing emissions to be curtailed. Years ago, the environmentalists would have taken to the street for that, but they don't seem to be willing to do that today. I mean, they're just not radical enough anymore to get the public's attention. They've compromised with industry too much. How do you react to that, Michael? Well, I don't get a reaction from John.
Yeah, and I actually don't believe that this is a problem of left and right. I actually think it's a problem of vision. And the environmental movement really, again, has been telling people only the I have a nightmare speech. We haven't been telling people the I have a dream speech. We haven't been getting people excited, like you're saying, around the kind of America that people want to live in. And I think that what's unique about conservatives and their power, what comes from their the reason they're so powerful politically right now, is that they're not so literal about getting people behind every aspect of their agenda. So President Bush did not run for re-election on privatizing Social Security or invading Iran. He ran on a much different platform, whereas I think environmentalists, and I think it also goes to all of the liberal special interests, including much of the Democratic Party politics, are very literal. We kind of provide these laundry lists of things that we expect Americans to care about, and the truth is they don't care about most of the stuff that we care about as strongly, and we need to fashion a politics that gets people excited about supporting our agenda, but not necessarily for our reasons.
Ira, let me give you a concrete example, and it applies to this question of global warming. One of the ways in which we waste immense amounts of energy on this planet, right, is moving food around every which way, because it's always summer someplace and we're going to, you know, bring in apples from New Zealand or whatever it is. If you imagined, and there have been a number of papers even in recent weeks demonstrating the degree to which you could reduce fossil fuel use simply by having people eat from considerably closer to their homes. Well, this kind of local foods movement is something I've been working about. It's part of the new book that I'm working on. But it's not at all clear whether or not it's a liberal or a conservative idea to trade with your neighbors instead of trading with people halfway around the world. And the beauty of it is, it's, you know, one sells it, one talks about it, not as something that you shouldn't do, but as something that you can do. Eat seasonally, eat locally, eat closer to home, know your neighbors, have things that taste better instead of the strawberry that flew 3,000 miles or whatever it is. There are things like that that we've got to begin trying out, seeing what works with people, instead of always beginning with the end, figuring out what the law is that we need and how many parts per million we can tolerate, and working backwards from there.
1-800-989-8255 is a number. Let's go to John in Washington.
Hello there. This is John Passacantando from Greenpeace, and it's wonderful to hear this debate. I've been following this. I run Greenpeace in the U.S., and I've been sending these papers, the opening ones and all the follow-up ones, around to my staff, my board, because I think it's a very healthy debate to have.
Do you think the environmental movement is dead?
I don't know what you call dead. I think we're in a lot of trouble. If you look at these current votes, and if you look, you listen to those scientists, and you look at the way things are going on global warming, the planet is in deep trouble. And so it is a time to rethink. At Greenpeace, we tear ourselves apart all the time, saying, what do we do? We look at our groups that are, our colleague groups, that big national groups that are doing all the legislation and the lobbying, and they're getting steamrolled there. But if you look at us at the same time, we're blocking shipments of illegally logged mahogany. You know, Ashcroft tries to put us out of business for that. We test 10,000 people's hair for mercury contamination. The last guy just got out of prison yesterday after spending a month there for putting a banner on a smokestack. Initially, the FBI came after them, called them all terrorists. So the stakes have gone up. The energy industry is playing a lot harder and more aggressively, and in a more sophisticated way than our opponents did in the 60s and 70s. And so it requires that we think bigger and experiment with different tactics and strategies. So I don't necessarily agree with all the conclusions of Michael, but I think it's very important to mix it up and push ourselves to do a lot better than we're doing because there's too much at stake.
Hang on a second. We're talking about the global warming and the environmental movement and everything in between on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Let's role model here for a second. Let's talk about the energy policy. We don't have an energy bill in Washington. We don't have an energy policy in Washington, and the president even is asking for an energy policy all the time. Why are we not seeing people coming up, marching in the streets? Why isn't Greenpeace or the NRDC or somebody else organizing a giant march that says we want to have better car CAFE standards? If you just give us 5 miles a gallon, we don't have to import all this oil. We don't have to worry about the energy policy. We don't have to drill in Alaska. We want that change. Why don't we see those things anymore like we used to in the old days?
Well, I'll tell you, the fact that we have managed to stop the White House from imposing a insecure, dangerous, industry-oriented energy policy working together with the Republican Congress and their friends in the industry, frankly, is a victory for the environmental community.
But that's the point. You're on the defense. Yeah. You have stopped something. You haven't started anything.
Well, we hope we're moving in that direction. And I think that in the course of this year, you're going to see much more discussion of energy policy in terms of real solutions, of ending dependence, of reducing our need for foreign oil in the first place. Now, there's no question that the Arctic vote this week was a bad beat, but it was also a vote for Exxon and Texaco and Chevron. We hope that we're going to have a more constructive agenda, and the fact that the administration has been stopped in its tracks, despite an unprecedented lobbying effort and unprecedented arm twisting, is the first step in turning this around to a more positive
and
direction.
I think I think that would be my point. Is the defense of this? You know, what can you start? What can you draw the American people in to feel that they are part of the movement instead of just being on Vanguard? Go ahead.
It's clear, I think, that we're not going to, that in the next 4 years, there's not going to be all that much action except defense in Washington. You know, that's, I'm afraid, the political state of the affairs. The only silver lining in that is that it frees us to go spend a lot of time in other places, state capitals, city halls, and in places like churches and so on, doing the groundwork and doing the experimentation and the modeling that really might get us somewhere. The last place on planet Earth that doesn't understand about global warming is inside the Beltway.
Bill's absolutely right.
That's not going to change in the next few years, but we can at least do some more creative things than we've been doing in Albany and in Sacramento and in Montpelier, where I am, and on and on and on, in order to have something, you know, if we gain more political traction at some point.
I always thought that the greatest defeat is losing the idea that that environmental policy leads to loss of jobs. I mean, if you're green, you lose jobs, and you've lost that battle so far.
Well, I'm going to jump in there, Ira.
Yes.
Can I jump in?
Yes.
I think what I hear you getting at is really that it's not clear what kind of an America the environmental movement wants to create. And there is one idea that my co-author Ted Nordhaus, who's a pollster, and is an idea that, in fact, the NRDC and the Sierra Club and other big environmental groups have endorsed, is an idea of something called a new Apollo project.
Well,
we could put a man on the moon.
Right.
We can create the new energy industries of the future. It's interesting. I mean, you asked before about the way in which the category of the environment, which either means it includes everything, in which case it's meaningless, or it excludes humans, in which case it's politically suicidal. We tested the concept in Pennsylvania, which is a key battleground state, and we asked people an open-ended question: what are the biggest concerns facing them and their community? Only 2% said the environment. 68% said the economy. The rest said something around national security, social security, schools, and health. And so we decided to do some focus groups with Reagan Democrats or swing voters in that state. And we just asked them to talk about what's been happening in their communities. And they talked about all the factory closures, the jobs going overseas. And we introduced the idea of a major shared investment into the clean energy industries of the future, an investment that would be made like the investments we made in highways, in the internet, in electronics and other technologies to create jobs in Silicon Valley. They got very excited about the idea. I mean, they were literally speculating around, could these jobs come to their hometown? And what we discovered is that after they started talking more and more about the economic and jobs benefits of such a program, they started talking about the benefits around the environment, on global warming and clean air. But we had to start by appealing to some pretty core American values around a better world, a better life for their children, better jobs for themselves, the American dream. And from there, we got to the environment. And I think that environmentalists, while they support Apollo, they haven't really gotten behind the kind of the big and bold nature of the investment of the vision. And I also think it's sort of deeply uncomfortable for many environmental leaders, the extent to which the Apollo project really begins with a conversation around American dream and not with the I have a nightmare speech.
John Kaufman, can you get around that idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some issues with the Apollo project in particular that cause some difficulties. But as to Michael's broader point, I think that that's entirely consistent with where we've been headed with this discussion in the last few years. As Bill McKibben said earlier, the one virtue of a complete standstill on these issues in Washington is that it has freed us up to start looking at different places and different ways to go talk about these issues. We were in Detroit for the auto show this year talking about exactly these same sorts of things, better, cleaner, more efficient technology, and the fact that we need these solutions or the American automakers are going to get killed. You've got, the management in Detroit is in the process of riding an outdated business model in a death spiral.
Look what happened to GM this week.
General Motors announced this week they are going to lose $845 million in this quarter alone. Their stock price is in the tank. Thousands of people are going to be laid off, not just at GM, but at their suppliers. And we're talking really about the economic heart of the Midwest.
And why don't they get it that no one's going to buy their cars except Americans? I mean, they're building these giant SUVs, the way they make their biggest profit, but the rest of the world doesn't want these cars.
And increasingly, Americans don't want them. And you've got a 6-month backlog of these vehicles.
The Chinese aren't going to buy them. The Europeans want smaller cars. They want greener cars. They want greener industries. Why can't that be the selling point, that the jobs that are going to be created are not going to be the kind of jobs that American industries are going to give them unless they change?
Right. And on that, I think we agree completely with Michael and Ted, and that vision of solutions, of jobs, of better communities, of, frankly, a patriotic spirit. And that's something that I think historically lots of people who identify themselves with a progressive movement have been maybe a little queasy about. And it's something that we have to get comfortable with and learn to talk about to America, red state, blue state, or anywhere else.
And you have to go out to those states.
Yeah.
One of the things I think that was interesting about Michael's piece was talking about, it's interesting to point out that that environmentalists come from states where they don't have much of the, quote, environment in them. They're urban populations. But if you go out to the environmental states where there is the environment, the open spaces, they consider themselves to be experts already because they manage their systems. They manage their forests and their open air places. And you go in there and you say, well, we're going to tell you how to do it better. Maybe you need to, to figure out how to talk to them better and bring them on board.
There, even in the reddest of the red states, in the most rural parts of this country, there are people waking up quickly to the economic damage inflicted by what we're doing at the moment. For instance, I was in Wyoming last summer in Park County, I think, which is one of the most conservative places in the country, but threatened with a Walmart moving in and destroying their town. People in the community I was in went out and raised money among their neighbors to build a locally owned community dry goods store there in town, so they wouldn't, as it turns out, be driving 30 miles each way to Walmart, and so that their community wouldn't be destroyed. That was a powerful environmental statement, even if that's not how people perceived it or laid it out to be.
1-800-989-8255. Carol Ann in Ann Arbor. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there.
Can you hear me okay?
It sounds like the commercial, just as clear as the commercial.
Okay, I just got to work, and I'm starting work on a massage client, and I have you on speaker. So.
Go ahead. I think you're okay.
All right, cool. First of all, I wanted to say that I think some of us are trying to do what we can. Like, I buy organic. I'm not buying tuna anymore. I don't think that my movement is dead, but the administration that's in there now that I didn't vote for is doing their best to knock back as many environmental laws as they can, I don't think because they care. And Europe and maybe parts of Asia are trying to do more with the government. And please, if there's more ideas for us to do something, I mean, we want to do something, you know, especially people that are having kids. And, you know, I lived in the Detroit area, and I was appalled at what happened at the Detroit Auto Show. There's nothing there for us. Anyway, I'll take my comments.
Okay. Don't let go. Thank you.
I think that what the caller is speaking to, and I really appreciate her comments, is really the helplessness and the hopelessness that people feel. I mean, here we are voted against Bush. You know, we do our best we can to live our lives in a way that's consistent with our values, and still we're losing so badly. And I think that part of the challenge is that we need to understand that we need a new politics, that we need a new political movement, and that really you know, that this focus on sort of, you know, the 1,001 things you can do for the environment today has really distracted us in some ways of the collective action that we need to take. And to that extent, I think that we need to be looking not simply outside of Washington, but also in Washington. We need to find ways to actually go and have a set of political fights that attract people to us and divide our opponents. And that elevate our values and expand our vision into American life. I don't think that we need to retreat. I think that we need to attack.
Well, as long as you look at this as a blue against red state thing, you're not going to get much crossover.
Well, I don't think we should. I think that, I mean, what we were getting at with the Apollo idea is that here's something that, in fact, in the research that we've done, actually resonates more strongly with blue-collar swing voters than it does with the Democratic base. And I think that that's, you know, well, I think it's great that, you know, John supports the idea in principle. I think we have yet to see the big environmental organizations be willing to play a behind-the-scenes role in really advancing a political fight with allies who are going to be able to articulate and represent some of those core American values and vision.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Look who finally stood up to Walmart, you know, the most community-destroying force in this country at the moment. It wasn't really the environmental movement. It's been organized labor, the SEIU, others who've really begun, and environmentalists and others working on a local level who've begun to take this on. That's one of the great environmental fights, even if it's not going to be called by that name, of the decade ahead.
Especially if it's not going to be called by that name, I would add.
Yeah. That's right. Well, when you say, you know, you say those things about Walmart, you upset a lot of people who work, you know, and Walmart has provided jobs for them. And they're going to say, well, here's just another one of those tree huggers that's bad-mouthing us. Why should we ever want to listen to anything he says?
That's right. That's because the way that it needs to be addressed is the way that people are finally beginning to address it, to say, what happens when a Walmart comes to your community? It destroys 1.5 jobs for every job it creates. It lowers the wage scale for everyone there. There's a University of Pennsylvania study now in wide circulation showing that counties become steadily poorer as Walmarts move in and take root. That's how we got to argue it, not that, like, the parking lot's too big and there's going to be, like, a lot of runoff into the stream or something. When you get right down to it, that's the least of the, you know, impacts. What it really does is wipe out strong communities. And in any kind of environmental future that we can imagine, strong communities have to be at the heart of it. The good news is that in any kind of sort of working social future we can imagine too, strong communities have to be at the heart of it. This is this is where these things really begin to coincide, to all these forces begin to come together with a vision of a world that's sweeter than the one we live in now.
Hi, Barry in Peach Orchard, Missouri. Hi.
How are you doing?
Fine.
I thought the comments on Walmart were interesting. I'm a cotton farmer, and you know, grew up in the 60s and 70s, and like a lot of people, man, we were all behind the environmental movement. But you know, farming over the last 30 years has adopted a lot of what the environmental movement said were its goals. But we still find ourselves being attacked by environmentalists, you know, oftentimes for the very things that make the goals possible, things like genetically modified crops that allowed us to cut chemical use, cut runoff, cut erosion, cut fuel use, cut pollution, and it seems like the environmental movement doesn't know when it's found a friend.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting because Michael made that point in his story, in his piece about the trade-off made over Anwar early on, drilling in Alaska versus making a deal with the auto workers over CAFE standards, and lost both places.
Well, it seems like the environmental movement, at least the way we see it, has become more interested in being an anti-corporate movement, and seems to be more afraid that someone might make a dollar than they are about working with somebody who really is working towards the same goals. I mean, agriculture, obviously, 100 years from now, I still want my great-greats to be farming the same farm. Mm. You know, I have the same goals as an environmentalist does, but I'm attacked for it because I use a genetically modified variety of cotton on the crop.
Mm-hmm. Well, hang on a second. Let me just give a station ID. We're talking about the environmental movement this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So you think that you're being upset because you're being applied to all farmers and thinking that you're just one-dimensional.
Well, what I think has happened is that the environmental movement has shifted its interest away from, you know, actually looking at the environment, what makes sense, and working with people who, you know, I mean, obviously farmers have to make a living.
Yeah.
Walmart is going to make a dollar. Texaco is going to have to make a dollar. If they can find ways to work with them to modify existing technologies or modify existing techniques to become more efficient, you know, they'll be successful. But when someone comes in, you know, and just wants to knock you in the head with a ball peen hammer, it's just easier to ignore them. And I do trust Monsanto more than I trust an environmentalist, because at least Monsanto is working with me to keep me in business.
Let me get a reaction from John Koipman of the NRDC. John, how do you bring somebody like this in who is a conservationist because he has a farm?
Well, first thing I'll do is try and leave my ball peen hammer here in the studio.
Thanks.
Look, we don't grow the crops at NRDC. We don't build the cars. We don't write the software that runs the country. We don't do any of that stuff. We are an advocacy organization, and we're oriented as much as possible to finding good solutions, good safeguards, good standards that protect communities, that protect the people that live in them, and to make sure that we're all living on a healthy planet. The environment, of course, is not a place that we go visit. It's not something that sits up on a shelf. It's where we all raise our families. It's where we make a living. And I think that the comments the caller raises are important and interesting ones. These aren't simple challenges. And you know, the victories of the 1960s and 70s have only paved the way, both for progress, but moved us on to a new set of challenges. And that's really where we're looking forward to in this century.
All right. Thanks for calling. Good luck to you. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can go to John in, is it Auburn, Missouri? Or Michigan?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, John.
Yes, hello?
Hiya, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a comment. My highest priority is the environmental movement, and I give money constantly to these organizations. And the thing that frustrates me is there's so many of them, and there seems like they're all often on their own special agenda. What I would recommend, what you guys do for the next 4 years, since you can't do anything in Washington anyway, is why don't you form like a United Way for, you know, some sort of an umbrella organization where people could give their money and their energy to one place, and then you could take all the individual organizations that exist now that could be underneath that umbrella and, you know, pursue their special interests, their special, thing that they want to work on. But have one place where you could give your money and energy to, because it's very frustrating for a person like me trying to figure out what all these different organizations that aren't really working together. I mean, they're all interested.
So you can sense that there's disharmony here.
Plenty.
And just imagine what a Washington lobbyist can sense.
So I think if the environmental movement had an overarching type vision with some priorities and some goals, and they spoke with one voice to the people, it would be tremendously more powerful than what we're doing.
I got about 30 seconds. Let me get a comment. John, any?
Well, I'm not sure we're ever going to weed ourselves down to just one voice, nor do I think that that's necessarily the way to go. We're going to have different voices speaking to different people and different audiences. And, to the caller, I can only say that We do certainly do our best to work with our colleagues in Washington and other organizations, local communities. And
you think the battle's in the states now?
I think the battle is going to be really interesting in the state. Look at California, which has passed the world's first global warming emission standard for new vehicles. Governor Schwarzenegger.
Is it going to survive the challenge from Washington?
Well, we're going to be looking at a court challenge. All the major automakers have announced that they will file suit to block the law. Governor Schwarzenegger has said he is prepared to defend it. We are prepared to defend it, and we'll see. We're going to fight this one out in court.
All right. Thank you all. We've run out of time. John Kaufman, Director of Media Relations for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Bill McKibben, author of The End of Nature, is also scholar in residence at Middlebury College in Vermont. Michael Schellenberger, Executive Director of the Breakthrough Institute and co-author of The Death of Environmentalism, published in the online magazine Grist. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. I'm Ira Flatow, reminding you to visit sciencefriday.com, where you'll find Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curricula for teachers and parents to use based on our programming. Just click on the Teachers button on the left side of the page. And thanks for listening.